From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The actor Charles Laughton once said, "I act because people don't know what they're like, and I think I can show them." On today's Fresh Air, we talk about acting with Simon Callow, the author of a biography of Charles Laughton and an autobiography about his own acting career. Also today, wine expert Robert Parker tells us how he keeps his palate clean and his body sober during long wine tastings. And of course, we ask him for some tips about wine. And we have reviews of the new movie, Clean and Sober, and of the recent live album from the rock band X. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is the British actor Simon Callow. He originated the role of Mozart in the British stage production of Amadeus. He was also featured in the film in a smaller role as the impresario who wrote the libretto for The Magic Flute. You may also remember Callow as the Reverend Beebe in the movie A Room with a View. It was the Reverend who convinced the chaperone, played by Maggie Smith, to accept a gentleman's offer of trading her hotel rooms for his two rooms with a view.
I am the chaperone to my young cousin Lucy, and it would be a serious thing if I were to put her under an obligation to people of whom we know nothing.
I don't think much harm could have come of accepting.
Fair, Charlotte.
So you think I ought to have accepted? You think I have been narrow-minded?
I never suggested that. If you will allow me, I would be happy to act as intermediary with Mr. Emerson. I do not think he would take advantage of your acceptance, nor expect any gratitude. He has rooms he does not value, and he thinks you would value them.
Charlotte, please.
Simon Callow has just completed an autobiography titled Being an Actor. He's also written a biography of the British actor Charles Laughton. Callow says Laughton's greatest achievement was his performance as Quasimodo in the 1939 film The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Callow writes, "This performance is acting at its greatest." This is Laughton as the Hunchback.
I never realized till now how ugly I am. And because you're so beautiful. I'm not a man. I'm not a beast. I'm about as shapeless as the man in the moon.
Simon Callow opens his biography of Charles Laughton with this statement. He writes, "The starting point of this book was my realization that I was not, after all, Charles Laughton."
Yes. I mean, I didn't really seriously think I was Charles Laughton, but I'd been sort of modelling myself on his general approach. That is to say, I'd been trying to push myself as far emotionally and physically as he did. And the day came when I thought I'd try one of his roles. And it was a play called On the Spot, which is by Edgar Wallace, and is really a play about Al Capone. Though disguised, he's called Tony Pirelli, but it was actually about Al Capone. And Laughton had his most enormous success on the English stage in 1930 with that play. And people were completely startled by the psychopathic intensity mixed with a kind of extremely oily sensuality. It was very sexy and very dangerous and very odd. And all of that, I discovered when I read the play, was in Charles's performance and not really in the play. The play is a melodrama, in fact. But I thought, well, you know, now I'll see, you know, if I can take on this part and if I can do as well as or even come anywhere near what Charles Laughton allegedly did. And I found after a terribly short time of rehearsal that I just hadn't got it in me. I didn't know where he got it from. It certainly wasn't from the play. It was from inside himself. And I just hadn't got that thing. What he had was, he obviously had access to a terrible ugliness inside himself. And I just couldn't quite find that in myself. As I said at the time, I did manage it somehow. I did manage to squeeze out some of this sort of psychopathic murkiness that Charles obviously produced very freely at will.
So if you decided you weren't his kind of actor, did you decide what kind of actor you were?
Well, I just discovered that what I was interested in was nothing to do with portraying all of that. What I was actually interested in personally was portraying innocence. And everything that I have ever done that's been any good at all has been a portrayal and, in some cases, a celebration of innocence.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was just rewatching your performance in Room with a View, and that coincides very well with what you're saying, I think.
Yes. I mean, that is something that Room with a View was a part that I sort of thought, well, clearly this is not a part one should do anything with at all. I thought that what the Reverend Beebe really was a good man, mm-hmm. and that one should just try to be good. And I found it I found it quite easy. And it quite surprisingly. I mean, it's interesting about acting. What you can do as an actor is not necessarily what you are as a person at all, but it's just what you are able to tap. And whenever I've had to play, when I played Richard III, I was just unconvincing, frankly. Unconvincing to myself as a man with monstrous intentions. And whenever I've played these characters, I played in Don Levy's play, The Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B, there's a character called Beefy, and that's a hugely open and generous and innocent man. And it seemed to fit me like a glove.
I want to ask you a little bit about your biography of Charles Laughton. Now, you think that his greatest performance was in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I've seen that movie a lot of times, and it's really one of my very favorite movies. Laughton was a heavy man during part of his life and didn't think of himself as an attractive man. Do you think he identified a lot with the character he was playing?
I think it went beyond identification. I think he projected his deepest, darkest feelings about himself, his dislike, as you say, of his own body, onto a huge canvas. I mean, he certainly he did identify with Quasimodo, but he also externalized that feeling and turned it into an epic feeling of self-rejection. I must explain, I think it's quite an important thing to say. It's a commonplace of criticism of Charles Laughton that he didn't like his own body, that he thought he was ugly. And the question that I asked myself was, if a man thinks that he's ugly, why would he parade that fact in front of millions of people?
Mm-hmm.
And I added to that the interesting fact that I had heard from many people, that whenever Charles Laughton was alone at home, I mean among friends, or even not among friends, but when he was at his house by his pool in Los Angeles, the first thing he would do would be tear off all his clothes and stand naked and very fat and very strikingly very unattractive. Now, it doesn't seem to me that somebody who really dislikes themselves does that. It seems to me that Charles Laughton actually used a certain feeling that he had about himself and amplified it and magnified it to turn it into art of some kind.
Now, you said that you think he risked madness
for
going as deeply as he did into his performance as Quasimodo, the disfigured hunchback in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Tell us a little bit about the kind of makeup and the hump that he had to use to physically resemble Quasimodo. It is really one of the... I remember when I first saw that as a child, I was just horrified at the way that he looked. Describe a little bit his face and his back, and then what kind of makeup he had to carry to pull that off.
Well, he He devised that makeup in conjunction with a man called Perse Westmore, who was the most famous makeup artist, really, of all time. And they didn't really like each other at all. But Charles was a relentless taskmaster, and he knew very clearly what he wanted. And he pushed Perse Westmore further and further and further until he devised this amazing structure for his face. I mean, on his back he had a kind of a structure made of a light steel frame.
Which would be very heavy, probably.
And foam padding, which was strapped onto him. He had to be strapped into it. And that was extremely uncomfortable, especially when you remember that the film was filmed in September of 1939, and that year was as hot as it's just been in New York. And people were going mad in the same way. And Charles Laughton wore this terrible frame on his back and all this foam rubber inside. And on his face, he had a huge rubber and latex structure which contained within it a false eye which actually worked.
You mean it could move?
Yes, it moved. It was lower. It was down on his cheek. The other eye was blocked out completely. And it moved. It was linked by a thread to his other eye, to his own eye. So as every time he blinked with his free eye, the false eye blinked as well. And that was a structure of wires and threads underneath the mask. And the rest of his face was pushed out of all proportion. His jaw was pushed forward. And as I say, there was this terrible heat all the time.
So he really suffered every time he got into the character.
He suffered every time. He clearly needed... I mean, he felt that it was necessary to suffer in order to give the performance. But as I point out in the book, the most striking thing about the performance is not how much he indulges in the pain, but what a stoical character he endows Quasimodo with. You understand that he suffers terribly from his ugliness and from his physical deformity. But in fact, what you see is Quasimodo rising above that. And you see an essential sweetness and a simplicity of the man.
What a really good point. You know, there's the scene where he's on the wheel being lashed. This is the scene that ends with him begging for water.
Yeah.
You say that he had asked a makeup man to twist his foot
yeah.
to help him feel physical pain so he could express that pain in his acting.
That's right.
And I wonder what you think about that kind of acting where you need to actually physically experience the pain in order to express it as an actor.
I understand it. I understand that it is necessary. I understand that it can be very productive. I would never do it myself.
Why not?
In my case, first of all, I must admit, I'm sort of I'm squeamish about pain,
and, right.
and I don't want to suffer. I mean, I
don't blame you.
Very, very hard about making a film in the jungle. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just. Doesn't it's not something that sort of attracts me, suffering, but and it did attract Charles, obviously, but I'm not really drawn to the characters, the kind of characters that Charles was drawn to. I suppose if I were playing Quasimodo, I would have to do something like that. I find for myself, I mean, you must understand that at no point am I ever comparing myself with Charles Laughton in terms of greatness. He was what Beethoven is to composing, Laughton was to acting, in a league apart, and I'm not. I find that for myself, my mind seems to create the imaginative contacts. I don't find it profitable for myself to put myself into those kind of odd physical situations. I mean, many actors get great value from pretending to be the character and walking around the streets in character or something like that. That's never really particularly worked for me, but I respect it greatly. I find it fascinating.
You describe how Bertolt Brecht asked Laughton once why he acts.
Yeah.
And Laughton gave two great answers, and I want to ask you about each of them. First,
yeah.
Laughton said, "I act because I like to imitate great men."
Yes.
Why is that of interest to you? I find that a great answer.
It's a wonderful answer, and it must have delighted Brecht, because, first of all, he used the word imitate. He didn't say, like, I like to be great men, or I like to pretend. He said, I like to imitate. I like to look at and copy and then show to people. When you imitate somebody, you very definitely say, I mean, you say, I am taking on the characteristics of somebody else. Look what kind of a person this is. And that's what delighted Brecht. And it's what Charles did actually all the time. He didn't, I mean, he's been described as a method actor without the bullshit. That was what James Mason said of him. I'm not sure that he was completely without the bullshit, but he wasn't by any means a method actor in the sense that, perhaps wrongly, it has come to suggest someone who is more interested in what they're feeling than in what the audience is receiving. Lawton was always interested in what the audience was getting, and he wanted to demonstrate his characters.
Let's get to the second answer that Lawton gave about why he acts. He said he acts because people don't know what they're like, and he thinks he can show them.
Yeah.
What a terrific answer, you know, to try to explain people to themselves through acting.
Yes, exactly. He was a close observer of people, but more particularly a close observer of himself. And I think he was, you know, he was a very conscious man. That's very important to say about him. He knew what he was doing.
Does that sum up to you what great acting is, a performance that can show people what they are?
It certainly could be, yes. I mean, there are very many kinds of acting, but anything which affirms humanity, anything which says anything which celebrates the richness of human life, is yes, that begins to be a great performance to me.
My guest is Simon Callow. He's an actor and writer, and he's just written a biography of actor Charles Lawton and an autobiography about his own work on the stage and screen. And we're going to talk more about Charles Lawton and about Simon Callow after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Simon Callow is my guest. You may have seen him in Room with a View, playing the role of the Reverend Mr. Beebe. He also appeared in the film Morris, and he originated the role of Mozart in the British stage production of Amadeus. When you started to act, you write in your autobiography that you initially only wanted to play leads, and that later on you realized the importance of secondary roles. So I'd like to know what you think the importance of secondary roles is.
Oh, well, absolutely crucial. And, there's nothing more awful than watching a star performer surrounded by people who are not in his league. I mean, it's bad for him, it's bad for the play, it's bad in every way. But what is fascinating is how hard it is to play, as you call them, secondary roles, smaller parts, are very, very hard to play. As a leading actor, you've got the whole play and the whole extent of the role on which, as it were, to warm yourself up. And if you miss one scene, you don't play it quite as well as you should have done, you've got the next scene to recover on. But so often an actor playing a small part has really got to make his impact within this tiny compass. He's got to make all his points, and on the other hand, try not to sell it too hard, which you do sometimes see. You can often see in television programs, you know, people who've got to sort of break a play and play and finally get to play a small part on television, oversell it because it's they want to make an impact. They want to show people everything they can do all at once, and so you need a sort of restraint and a discipline. And it's fascinating how wonderfully great actors who've played very big leading parts, they play small parts so beautifully. Mm-hmm. They just etch them in because they have the absolute confidence of having used their whole instrument all the time. So it's like, you know, playing a violin or something. The violin has to be warm before you can play on it properly. And it's very hard as a small part actor to get warm.
In the movie Amadeus, you played a kind of secondary role. You were the impresario Emanuel Schikaneder?
That's right.
Who wrote the libretto for The Magic Flute, and as you describe him, he was covered in feathers during most of the performance. Now, you actually originated the role of Mozart in the original British stage production of Amadeus. And in your autobiography, you describe how difficult it was to make it convincing that this man who was portrayed as a real louse in the play would be capable of writing and performing such brilliant music. What key did you find to making it believable?
Well, what I did was to apply myself to the music more and more. I listened to it incessantly. I tried, this is a very hard thing to talk about, but I tried to kind of put the music into the center of me. I tried to sort of inject it into my spine so as there was always in my mind, as I think there must have been always in Mozart's mind, an endless flow of music bubbling out and pouring through. And I then played against that. Because, as you say, perhaps even more than in the movie, in the stage play, Peter Schaffer's created a very partial view of Mozart. I mean, it's all true, but it's not the whole truth about Mozart. And he wanted to show what was well attested by all his Mozart's contemporaries, that he was a pain in the ass most of the time, and a kind of childish, noisy, vulgar creature. And I had to find, though, as you said at the beginning, I had to make it credible that that man wrote that music.
You know, we were talking earlier about Charles Laughton's looks and how he thought of himself as being ugly, and how he ended up playing the disfigured hunchback of Notre Dame. Do you think acting has become more about looking good than it once was? I'm thinking now that so many of the leading younger actors get to act because they're good-looking. And it just appears to me as a viewer that it's getting more and more difficult for actors who are not beautiful or handsome to get good performances, I mean, to get good parts.
Yeah. Yes, I think that is probably true. I mean, I've got nothing against people looking good, and it's very nice to look at them for a while. But it is an interesting question, one which I have no answer for, as to whether people who are terribly good looking really make an encounter with themselves which would lead to interesting acting. I mean, Betty Davis, rather sagely, said a long time ago, she said, I'm not saying you have to be neurotic to be an actor, but I don't believe that anybody who likes themselves ever became one.
Really? And does that have resonance for you?
Oh, deeply, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the most wonderful escape partly into other characters or other parts of yourself that you might have been, but also into a sort of, what I always say, there's a kind of perfection about acting. I mean, you say all the right things, you do the right moves. It's for the period that you're on the stage or in front of the camera, you are actually perfectly fulfilled. And life can be very disappointing sometimes by comparison. But certainly, I mean, I don't think I would have become an actor if I hadn't felt ill at ease with myself.
Charles Laughton was a homosexual or bisexual, I guess I'm not sure which, but you described that as being one of the big secrets of his life and something that you think finally helped energize his acting. And I was wondering if you think it's any easier now for gay actors in England or the United States to come out, and if you think that the scene, as far as coming out, is any different in England than it is in the United States.
I think it might be. In the book that I wrote, Being an Actor, I made a point of saying that I was gay. And as far as I knew, or know, no other actor had ever volunteered such information about himself. I mean, one or two actors had, as it were, got caught in the act, and therefore people knew. But I'm not aware of any other actor in England who had said that he was gay, or she was gay. It didn't seem to have any terrible repercussions on my career, but then on the other hand, I've never been a romantic actor, and therefore maybe it there was no question of people not being able to believe in me as a straight lover or something like that. But last year, which is a very important thing politically, Ian McKellen came out, and he's a sort of leader. He's a natural leader, and he's been extraordinary. And maybe he has transformed the position completely. Still, not very many actors have actually openly said they're gay, and I really do think it's terribly important. I don't honestly see how anything can change in the position of a homosexual actor unless all the gay actors just say, well, I'm gay, and that's all. That's all you have to say. That's all that's needed. And it really it doesn't seem to have made any difference. I believe that in England, at any rate, despite all the horrors of AIDS, that the general feeling towards homosexuals is very much more... It's more relaxed. I think it is now understood by a large percentage of the population that some people are gay and some aren't. And that's all, you know. I don't think that one is looking for people to say, well, gay is good, gay is great, gay is best, or whatever. Just, you know, some people are gay and some aren't. That's all. As I said on some programme in England, the day that every mother who has a family says, well, some of my children are going to be gay and some are going to be straight, and that's one of those things, then we will really have had, the revolution will have occurred.
We're really out of time, but let me ask you really quickly. Is part of the reason why you came out because you had seen gay actors have to publicly repress so much that it had a negative effect on their lives and their career because they couldn't be honest?
Yeah, partly. I mean, the main reason was just personal. It's just that I'm very bad at keeping secrets, and I just thought it was absurd. I'm very bad at telling lies.
It's funny an actor should say that they're bad at telling lies.
Well, it's funny that you should think that it's funny. acting has nothing to do with lying. Acting has everything to do with telling the truth.
I guess that's true, but it's the ability to be somebody else and be it with conviction, and to say something that you don't necessarily believe with conviction.
You use other parts of yourself. I mean, you never become anybody else. You only become what you might have been. So it's not a lie. I mean, all these things are in all of us. I mean, if I play a fascist and I say fascist-like things, if I say them merely as the kind of thing that other people sometimes say, then it'll be of no use at all. Only if I reveal the fascist in me when I say them, and there is one, and there is in everyone, will it be any use?
I want to thank you so much for talking with us about acting. Thank you.
Bye.
My guest has been actor and writer Simon Callow. He's written a biography of actor Charles Laughton, and he's also written an autobiography about his own career. The autobiography is called Being an Actor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, my guest will be guitarist and singer Doc Watson. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, it's a tough job, but someone's got to do it. Wine expert Robert Parker samples as many as 200 wines every week. His appraisal of those wines, published in his own newsletter, have earned him a reputation as America's most influential wine critic. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the live double album from the rock group X, recorded on the band's home turf, Los Angeles, at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Clean and Sober, starring Michael Keaton and Kathy Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. West German authorities have confirmed they're holding former U.S. Army Sergeant Clyde Lee Conrad on espionage charges in connection with a spy ring that provided NATO secrets to the Eastern Bloc. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports from London that both German and U.S. officials say the case is an especially grave one.
Sergeant Conrad is accused of running a major spy ring, which operated for the last 10 years based in West Germany. German prosecutors say he used couriers from Sweden to funnel secret documents to Hungarian intelligence agents, who then turned the material over to the Soviet Union. The spying is said to have been carried out in exchange for large sums of money. The 40-year-old former sergeant, who's from Ohio, had been in the Army for 20 years. For nearly half that time, he was stationed at the Bad Kreuznach Army Base near Frankfurt, where he had access to military secrets. Among the documents believed to have been turned over were details of NATO defense plans for Europe, including U.S. Army contingency plans for fighting a ground war against the Soviets. One West German report said information about NATO missile positions and other military installations were also handed over. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
The foreign ministers of Iran and Iraq began face-to-face peace talks in Geneva today, but as Burton Bolag reports, the two sides spent only part of the time talking to each other.
The two delegations went into their first face-to-face meeting without a handshake and without even looking at one another. They spent 2 hours together with UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar acting as mediator. They then took what was supposed to be a 15-minute break, but afterward they stayed apart in separate rooms while the UN chief and his staff consulted with both sides. The entire exercise lasted 6 hours. Afterward, Perez de Cuellar said he was satisfied because the two sides appeared really interested in finding a solution. It isn't clear whether the fact that the two sides spoke to one another only part of the time represented an early problem in the peace talks. In any case, after consulting with their capitals, the two sides are to resume negotiations tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
The redesigned joints on the Space Shuttle booster rocket did their job perfectly during last week's test firing, that despite deliberate flaws built into the joint by test engineers. Technicians from Morton Thiokol, the makers of the booster, finished their post-test inspections of the O-ring joint and today announced the joint sealed completely. Despite this summer's drought, the nation's economy managed healthy growth during the second quarter of this year. The Commerce Department reports the gross national product grew at a 3.3% rate from April through June. At the same time, though, the government says inflation hit a six-year peak of 5.1%. The increase was caused by higher prices for food, energy, and clothing. A Washington-based consumer group today charged that most public school cafeteria lunches fail to meet U.S. dietary guidelines. A report by the Public Voice for Food and Health Policy says there's too much fat, sugar, and sodium in the food served to public school students. Ellen Haas, the group's executive director, says the report can help solve the problem.
If parents get involved and parents find out how the school lunch program is not meeting the health needs of their children, I think that puts pressure on the Department of Agriculture that just has not been doing its job. I think the more the public knows about it, the more that our public policies will change.
Haas complains that the USDA, which spent $3.7 billion on the National School Lunch Program last year, has done little to ensure that the food served in public school cafeterias follows nutritional guidelines. A tropical depression that devastated Puerto Rico is now swirling over the Dominican Republic, where flash flood warnings are in effect. The storm system yesterday dumped more than 6 inches of rain on Puerto Rico. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 16 points, closing at 2010.85. Declines led advances. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. X is a band that emerged from the Los Angeles hardcore punk scene of the late 70s. Their records and concerts have won them a small but devoted following, but they've never enjoyed a major commercial success. Now X is trying to make their mark with a new live album of old favorites and previously unreleased tracks. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Well, hello, everybody. And welcome to the Whiskey A Go-Go on the fabulous Sunset Strip.
The fact that X has recorded its most recent album, as the title says, live at the Whiskey A Go-Go on the fabulous Sunset Strip, is more significant than it might seem at first. For 10 years, this Los Angeles band has written music about what it's like to be a Los Angeles band, in specific detail. Take, for example, a song called The Unheard Music. The band's leaders, Exene Cervenka and John Doe, wrote it about the time 10 years ago when the Whiskey A Go-Go, a legendary rock music club, wouldn't let the band on its stage. Too primitive, the band was told, too punk. That sort of attitude only lasted a year or so, because by the end of the 70s, X was just about the most popular local band in L.A. And there's at least one other reason the Whiskey A Go-Go haunts this band. In 1980, Exene's sister Mary was on her way there to see the band perform. As she crossed Sunset Boulevard to enter the club, she was hit by a car and killed. That's Johnny Hit and Run Pauline. Even at its most intense, X has always had a dark, brooding, unique sound, something that arises from the wildly divergent backgrounds of its members. Exene Cervenka was a poet before she started singing with the band. John Doe had been a journeyman rock guitarist who fell in love first with her poems and then with her. Their marriage a couple of years into the existence of X became a recurring topic in their collaborative songwriting. Drummer DJ Bonebreak had played with jazz bands before deciding that the simplicity of X's punk style was more intriguing. And the band's original lead guitarist, Billy Zoom, had been a pure rockabilly revivalist, well-versed in 50s classics. He, too, suddenly found a kinship with L.A.'s loose and exhilarating punk scene. Zoom left the band a couple of years ago, and X's current lead guitarist, Tony Gillickson, does a good job of reproducing Billy Zoom's original crashing guitar lines. X benefits most from the tension created by the band's raucous music and Exene's real poetic gift, a talent for making a small, specific image stand for a much larger issue or idea. That's certainly true of one of the band's earliest and best songs, which has a title that sums up everything I've been describing. It's called The World's a Mess, It's in My Kiss. It's also a song in which Exene's vocal emphasizes that creative tension. Her pitch wavers all over the place, yet this is great rock singing. Ungainly sounds that operate as music, as conversation, as art.
Thank you.
One of the last songs on this collection is a roughed-up, moving version of Woody Guthrie's So Long. It's the song that almost seems to confirm the rumor that this release may well be the band's last. Having tried to crack the rock and roll mainstream for 10 solid years, the band may have decided to give up. If they do, it's certainly true that not many rock fans will go into mourning. This was never a band for mass culture consumption, but X has certainly left behind a fitting testament.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Well, I sung this before and I'll sing it again, about the place that I lived on the wild, windy plains, in a state of confusion in the county of L.A. Here's what all of my friends, they did say, honey, so long, it's been good to know you, so long, it's been good to know you, so long, it's been good to know you, the dusty old dust has taken my home, and I gotta be drifting.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Parker would like to see the average American reach for a glass of wine with a meal the way they might reach for a Coke. Parker is considered by many to be one of the world's leading wine critics. His newsletter, The Wine Advocate, has the influence to make or break a vineyard. He's also written three books on his favorite subject. Parker says he started writing about wine to help the consumer choose the best buy for the money. That was 10 years ago. Today, Parker tastes nearly 10,000 different wines a year. I asked him what he looks for in a wine.
A wine that smells like a barnyard or smells like a chemical plant is obviously a bad wine and not terribly enjoyable. I think you're looking, I mean, it's like whether you're looking at a work of art or listening to music, you're looking for a certain harmony. And when I say harmony, I'm talking about a balanced impression in the mouth. You don't want the wine to taste tart like you're biting into a lemon. You don't want it to taste real acidic. You don't want it to taste astringent, as if someone were rubbing a piece of sandpaper across your tongue. You want to be able to taste something that is velvety and is enjoyable to drink. And if you can't reach that conclusion that's enjoyable, then something's probably wrong with the wine.
I know that there's some days when I just have a kind of funny taste in my mouth that I can't seem to get rid of. For you, that would really be an occupational hazard. What do you do to make sure that your palate is cleared before tasting a wine?
Well, there's no question that if you're going to taste wines, there are certain things that you should avoid. If you've been nibbling on a lot of chocolate bars, chocolate is absolutely, it leaves a residue on your palate that absolutely destroys the taste of both white and red wine. And so, you know, you want to stay away from chocolate. There are other foods. I mean, obviously you wouldn't go to your favorite Cajun restaurant and have a big spicy meal and want to drink a fine wine because wines just don't work with that sort of food. You know, if you'd like to eat a lot of garlic doesn't work that well with wine, especially fresh garlic. Vinegar is, of course, one of the taboos if you're going to taste a lot of wine. But I find some of these are overworked. I mean, this whole field of wine food matchups has probably been so legislated by the wine press that it actually intimidates people.
How many hours before you taste wine do you brush your teeth?
Well, I get up very early in the morning and I brush my teeth, but I never drink coffee the day that I'm going to be tasting wine. Coffee is another caffeine for me anyhow. I don't know how it affects other people, but for me, leaves a residue and gives the wines a certain sharpness. So I brush my teeth, but one of the things I do and have learned is sort of a trick of the professional wine tasting is I drink an enormous amount of water. And what I find the most refreshing thing for cleaning your palate, so to speak, after you taste 20, 25 wines, there's a certain amount of fatigue that sets in. I will drink, have Perrier or some other sort of sparkling water, and I'll taste that, gargle it, spit it out, and I find this tends to revive the palate.
When you're tasting wine, do you actually swallow it, or do you, like some wine tasters do, swish it around your mouth and then spit it out?
And when you're tasting professionally, you obviously can't, particularly when you're tasting the number of wines that I am, you can't possibly swallow the wine.
You'd be totally inebriated.
By mid-morning, if not earlier. So, I mean, I think you have to spit it out. I mean, some people say, gee, I can't really effectively taste the wine unless I swallow it. That's a myth. I mean, all you have to do, I mean, your tongue is divided into sort of tasting centers, and which pick up, you know, sharpness, softness, sugar, acid, and the impression of depth. Most of the wine evaluation, to be truthful, is really based on smell. But I spit, and what I do is, you know, I sort of take a sip of wine, and by pulling in air over the wine, all these aromas from the wine sort of oxidize and evaporate and go up into your nasal passages, and then by circulating it around on your palate and then spitting it out, the most important thing of telling the difference between a good and a great wine is that when after you spit it out, or in the case of someone who's drinking, swallowing the wine, is the perception that wine is still in your mouth, even after there's none there. It's this residue of the wine left on your palate or your tongue. Generally, that's called length or finish. And the great wines, I mean, the really outstanding wines, that perception can last 30 seconds, 45 seconds, even 60 seconds. I mean, I've even gone to the trouble of sitting watching my watch and saying, gee, can I still sense this wine there?
I'm interested in the language of wine writing. You have to come up with descriptions for every single wine that you taste. I just chose one at random, really. Here's a description of one of the many Bordeaux's in your Bordeaux book. You describe it as a rather loosely knit wine with very good color, jammy, grapey, fruit, low acidity, and a lush, supple texture. This medium to full-bodied wine has a precocious personality and a charming fruitiness and will evolve rapidly. The language of wine is so interesting. You know, it's like you're talking about a person, a precocious personality, a charming fruitiness. Is this like standard language for wine?
Well, I think one of the things that I didn't find attractive when I was reading a lot of wine books is that so much of the language about wine was very stilted, because I think England has long been recognized as the wine writing capital of the world. And the English, you know, used, I think, almost elitist terms and a very floral sort of writing style. And what I tried to do when I started writing was really be direct and simple. Now, you may find that description, you know, quite overly complex or something. But, I tried to, one, say, look, wines do have personalities. And I often, you know, you can compare certain wines to, a plump individual or a reticent or shy individual. And I keep it simple. I mean, if I started saying that this wine smells of mahogany or some sort of rare flower like a lot of wine writers have done for centuries, how many people know what that smells like? Even saying a wine smells like a truffle, how many people actually get a chance to taste a fresh truffle or something? I mean, I have used that term because I do sense that in certain wines. But I try and keep it very simple and very straightforward and try and use analogies to behavior characteristics of human beings, because I think wines are living and they're changing and they have personalities and character. And so if you can describe it in that sense, I think it's more meaningful to the reader.
You know, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it seems to me that in the United States, drinking wine is considered somewhat effete and effeminate. And you know how men are sometimes mocked for liking white wine? I mean, I can't really understand that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the general image of wine in the United States, unfortunately, is one of a sort of an elitist beverage. At least the fine wine sector, and I think this is unfortunate, and because to me it's a beverage for the masses. I mean, you just look at Western Europe, and I think the proof is that people are literally, wine is part of the meal, it's part of the culture. And I think in this country, we just have so much wine available for sale, and it's probably the most sophisticated marketplace in the world for wine. But I think what happens, the image of wine is that, one, it's you've seen advertisements for wine on television that I think are appalling. You see, a man being driven home in his black limousine by his chauffeur, and he pulls up to this multi-million-dollar mansion, and he's met by his butler with a glass of wine. That promotes an image of wine as an elitist beverage. And you go into a restaurant, I mean, one of the things that I think is atrocious in this country is that the great majority of restaurants, treat wine as a special event beverage. You go into the restaurant, and you look at the wine list, generally, it's impossible to get a decent, I'm not talking about a great bottle or a good bottle, I'm talking about a decent bottle of wine that doesn't cost more than your entire meal.
Wine is also an investment for some people, because the expensive wines are rare and can go up in value. Do you think that your wine writing, the books and the newsletters, affect the prices of wine?
Well,
who are investors?
I mean, I get accused of having a huge effect on the marketplace, and that causing prices to go up when I recommend certain wines. But I think that, I look at it as a sort of a byproduct of credibility that, if I didn't have, if people didn't believe in what I was writing about, they wouldn't obviously be buying the wines that I'd recommend. But I think it's really just the product of supply and demand. There's little of it left, and so the price goes up. I think I don't believe in wine as an investment. I never have. Certainly people have used my Wine Advocate as an investment tool. But I've never condoned it. I believe that if you're going to buy, you know, the fine Bordeaux and Burgundies and vintage port, I guess the three types of wines that are often looked at as investment-grade wines, you should be prepared to drink your investment. I mean, I think the thing about buying, let's take, for example, Bordeaux or vintage port early before it's mature or ready to drink, is that you can buy it at a much lower price. People have looked at this, and certainly they've said, gee, you can invest in wine and you can resell. Certainly in certain countries like the United Kingdom, they have actually tax schemes that have encouraged investment in wine. But I think it's a very dangerous game. And I think people, you can look for every person who's made a lot of money investing in wine. There are probably five or six people who have been stuck with wine that they bought thinking it was a good investment. And now they're faced with the fact of losing money on it or drinking it, and they probably didn't buy it to drink.
Do you invest in wine?
No, never have and never will.
Is there a wine drinking experience that stands out in your mind as just the best you've ever had?
Well, I've had a lot of awfully good ones. I think the only thing I say about wine drinking experiences, the best one are sharing really good bottles of wine with a lot of friends. I've never known someone who loved wine who wanted to drink it by himself or herself. And I think this is one of the great social benefits of wine drinking that probably gets overlooked. But I think great wine with some of your best friends and with some good food on the table is really, I mean, I can't really ask for anything more in life.
Well, Robert Parker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Robert Parker publishes his newsletter, The Wine Advocate, from his home in Parkton, Maryland. He spoke to us from NPR station WJHU in Baltimore. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's ahead on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we'll have a report on that American ex-serviceman who's been arrested in West Germany on suspicion of espionage. Allegedly, he ran a spy ring that funneled NATO and U.S. secrets to the Soviet Union via Hungary. Officials say it could be serious, but they don't know how serious it is yet. Also, Terry, have you seen the new McDonald's promotion?
I don't think so.
Well, let me tell you. If you buy Fiesta Chicken McNuggets, you get a shiny new South American coin this month. And so we talked to the Consul General of Costa Rica because we were curious, you know, what that involved. And as it turned out, it involved passing a special law in Costa Rica to export 5 million colognes.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Michael Keaton's last movie, the comedy Beetlejuice, the actor played a manic ghost who exorcises humans from a house inhabited by fellow ghosts. In his new movie, Clean and Sober, Keaton uses his manic energy in the dramatic role of a cocaine addict. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Clean and Sober is playing at a theater near you, but it shouldn't be. It's a natural-born TV movie. Which means what exactly? TV movies aren't simply a lesser cinematic form. They're different from movie movies, different in kind. Watching a real movie, we enter a precise and enveloping world, and the film's true subject is that world and the people who inhabit it. But a TV movie is always about a problem. The characters and the world they live in are around just to give that problem flesh and form, which is why the people in TV movies are always strangely vague. They've been softened, diluted, generalized. Clean and Sober, for instance, is not about Daryl Pointer, its main character, nor about the fast-track world he inhabits. This is a movie about the problem of drug and alcohol addiction. Daryl, played by Michael Keaton, is a man in trouble. As the movie opens, he's just waking up to a bad hangover, an OD'd girlfriend in bed at his side, and the discovery by his colleagues back at the real estate office that Daryl has just embezzled $90,000 from the company till. Clearly, our hero needs a place to hide. And it just so happens that the local drug rehabilitation center offers complete confidentiality. Of course, Daryl wants to make absolutely certain of that.
Let's say someone found out I was in here and tried to call me or wanted to get in here and bother me or something. Let me tell you why I asked. I got the police after me for some old traffic violations. And, you know, I think it'd be a really good idea if I just avoided any outside pressure for a while.
Well, then, this is probably the safest place you could be.
Michael Keaton is too good an actor for a TV movie. He makes Daryl jumpy and heartless and debonair enough to intrigue us. We want to know more about his Quicksilver character, the specifics, and the movie doesn't want to tell us. Instead, it wants to preach. We get high-minded speeches from the minions of the rehab center, down-home speeches from Alcoholics Anonymous members, and summing-it-all-up speeches from Daryl himself. Clean and Sober, in short, is a message movie. And yet, its message is strangely muffled. That's because, in typical TV movie fashion, all the story's roughest edges have been meticulously smoothed away. The hell of detoxification becomes one discreet upset stomach scene. The angst of therapy becomes a few arguments over who gets to use the telephone. The tough love offered by the head counselor, played by Morgan Freeman, is improbably tender. When middle-class Daryl falls for a blue-collar fellow addict, played by Kathy Baker, the movie makes her seem nearly as bourgeois as he is. She's as safe as milk, and the dangerous class gap these two have to bridge looks like a baby step. In other words, Clean and Sober makes kicking the habit seem strangely simple. For Daryl, it takes just a couple of weeks. This effect may even have been intentional. After all, if you make getting off the stuff look as horrifying as it really is, some people may just decide to stay on it. But Clean and Sober's approach backfires. Because we never discover whatever it is that might be singular in Daryl's world or in the messy depths of his character, this picture feels no more significant or compelling than any other example of cleanup chic. It has the glancing impact of a Just Say No ad. The director, Glenn Gordon Caron, is the man who invented TV's moonlighting. Maybe that's why Clean and Sober leaves you feeling as though drug addiction were the kind of problem you could solve between commercial breaks.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair, and he's a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet the man who kept Gilligan shipwrecked on that desert island for all those years. Sherwood Schwartz created and produced the hit TV series Gilligan's Island. It still has a following, and now Schwartz is working on Gilligan's Island, the second generation. Also, singer and guitarist Michael Cooney is back in our weekly performance spot. And Ken Tucker reviews new home videos, including one Ken calls an hour of high drama, basic plumbing. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.